In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about women's health and how it is that the way we think about women's health and women's involvement in their own health care has changed over the past several decades. It was back in 1970 that the landmark women's health book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, was first published. It has now gone through many printings. It has been translated into something like 20 languages, and there are books that are modeled on this book that have been produced in other countries. The focus has changed a little bit over time, at least in the sense that topics have been added. When the first book came out, it was very much focused on reproductive health and sexuality. But after that, a number of other topics were added, things like environmental health, menopause, aging. In 1998, a major update of the book was produced. And included a number of new topics, including things like finding good sources of health care information for women online, problems resulting from violence and overwork, even the concerns about girls' increasing use of tobacco. This version of the book, titled Our Bodies, Ourselves for the New Century, came out in 1998 and is available now out there in the bookstores if you would like to look at it. It's published by Touchstone Books. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with a guest who has been involved in this effort for some time. Judy Norsegian is Senior Program Officer with the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. And part of our reason for talking with her is to mention the fact that she will be here in Champaign-Urbana this weekend. She'll be speaking at the annual awards dinner of the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. That'll be on Saturday, the 19th. And they tell us that there are still tickets available for the dinner if you would like to attend. So for more information, you can call them at 352-6533. And of course, as we talk here in this part of Focus 580 with Judy Norsegian, questions are welcome. Questions, comments. All we ask of people is that they just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along and accommodate as many different callers as would like to call in. But anybody's welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, toll free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Norsegian, hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Well, I'm really pleased that you could be with us. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how it is that this whole thing got started and how Our Bodies, Ourselves came to be.
Well, you have to imagine in the late 60s that there were no books about women's health care, and most women had fairly disturbing experiences with their physicians, who are most often male, most often condescending and paternalistic, and not because they were bad people, but because their training encouraged that kind of behavior. And it was in part because of a conference held in Boston, a women's liberation conference that brought some women together to talk about health and sexuality issues, and their decision to continue to meet, that the seeds were planted for Our Bodies, Ourselves. Women continued to meet, decided they wanted to figure out how you choose a good doctor, and realized they were so ignorant. They didn't understand the most basic things about anatomy and physiology and medical and health care, and so they began to research issues. And the woman who'd had a postpartum depression looked at that. The woman who had a bad experience with a sexually transmitted disease, which was called venereal disease at that point, looked at that. Someone who'd had a bad birthing experience looked at the prevailing obstetrical practices. Someone who had an illegal abortion and didn't understand even what an abortion really was looked at that issue. And people basically came together, shared stories, as well as the practical information they had gathered from going to the local medical library at Harvard Countway, and also to talk to the few physicians and nurses who were receptive and responsive and said, this is terrific that you want to educate yourself, and I'll help you. There was no intent to write a book in the beginning, but the women ended up mimeographing these papers that they developed in the course of meetings and conversations, inserting people's personal experiences, and this combination of factual description and personal experience became the hallmark of Our Bodies, Ourselves. And in 1970, with the support of the New England Free Press, the local radical publisher, the book was published as Women and Their Bodies, subsequently Our Bodies, Ourselves. And we've seen about 7 major editions since then. And, of course, the book has grown to be fatter than a phone book.
It's a remarkable phenomenon, I think, and amazing that it it could have started the way that it did, as a very kind of local and grassroots and maybe personal sort of effort, and have grown into such a phenomenon that not only would it have sold so many copies here in the United States, but it would have inspired other kinds of books like it, and in all these different languages and all these different places.
Yes, in fact, it was incredible how much there was a need for this information. Even as a little newsprint 120-page booklet, it sold about 250,000 copies by word of mouth. That's why the commercial publishers got interested. And since the first commercial publication of Our Bodies, Ourselves in 1973, we've seen about 4.5 million copies sold here and around the world in 20-some-odd editions. And right now, women in Bulgaria, Armenia, Indonesia, China, Thailand, Tibet, Nepal, there's even a Ladakhi edition and little booklets in the work, Poland, and other countries, Senegal for French-speaking Africa. There's an Arabic edition that hopefully will be updated. The first was done by women in Egypt. Many of these books and books that were basically takeoffs from Our Bodies, Ourselves, they were adapted to meet the cultural and linguistic needs of a particular region. Many of these have changed. They've been reissued. They reflect the growing awareness of women's health groups around the world. There is quite a strong international women's health movement. And it's very exciting to see this kind of activism, to see the kind of information that women's groups are now developing and sharing. My own ethnic heritage is Armenian, so I'm quite excited to see that the Armenian edition will be printed these coming few weeks, and then I will have a copy in hand soon.
Mm. Maybe I should just here quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Judy Norsegian. She's Senior Program Officer with the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, the group that produced Our Bodies, Ourselves in 1970. As we've explained, has gone through many printings. It has grown. It's been translated into other languages and has been a real force in women taking charge of their own health care. Questions certainly welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I'd like to talk about maybe some of the things that have changed and some that have not over this time. One big change certainly, and not something just that touches women, but I think touches everyone, is that people are more involved in their own health care. They have been advised that they should question their doctors. They should ask questions if they're not sure why they're doing certain things. They should ask. They should learn about their bodies. They should, if they have particular health problems, they should learn about those. And now there are lots and lots of places to get that kind of information. Given the fact that people are, at least we think that they're more involved in their own health care, has that been a change for the positive as far as women and their health is concerned?
Well, as with many things, this is a double-edged sword. It is true there are many more sources of information. The problem is that some of the sources are industry-generated. They're really more about selling a product or a procedure than providing you with the information that you need to make the best choice for yourself. So the consumer, it's sort of a caveat emptor that has to be sort of adopted here. The consumer, the user, the layperson has to be very careful to know the source of the information. On the internet, there are fabulous sources of women's health information, and our own website, www.ourbodiesourselves.org, leads you to many of these sites. We've vetted them. Most of them are non-commercial. Many of them are government or academic sites, and they provide excellent information. We even include a few commercial sites, which have been particularly good. But many, many sites that don't look commercial really are, in terms of their genesis, who pays for them. And they don't necessarily provide balanced information. We have a serious problem now with so-called direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. And since 1997, the pharmaceutical industry has been spending a huge amount of money on advertising these products directly to consumers. In 1999, it was about $1.8 billion. In the year 2000, it was about $2.5 billion. And it certainly is working. Many of the drugs that did not sell as well as they are now are selling at a brisk pace. And it's not necessarily because people need these drugs. Sometimes older drugs that are less expensive work just as well. Sometimes they don't. But the person who's buying this new product may not necessarily be buying the right drug for the particular condition. One of our favorite examples now is the promotion of Prozac, one of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which has been repackaged as something called Sarafim for so-called PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And of course, many younger women are looking at the ads, which are very misleading, and thinking, oh, if I'm just a little bloated, if I'm just having an irritable day, I've snapped at my friend or my partner or my roommate, I should run off and get some Sarafim to calm me down. The ads are being pulled as the FDA catches up with the companies that misleadingly represent their drugs. But there is not necessarily a remedial ad campaign conducted. Only several of those are required annually. So many, many members of the public are misled by these so-called ads. And they're all over the Internet. They're all over magazines. And they're now beginning to be all over television as well. It's very difficult when there's no real penalty to be applied to a drug company that misleadingly represents its drug. It's really difficult to see that this behavior will change or to expect that it will change since there's no real penalty to be paid. We do hope that consumers, women in particular, will be more savvy about the sources of information. Books like Our Bodies, Our Cells don't get widely promoted, but because they're so trusted, because they're so accurate, because we spend a lot of time working with researchers, with both professionals and laypersons, to be sure that the information is both accessible and accurate, they generate consistent sales. But they're not enormous because there's no blockbuster media campaigns. We don't have huge budgets to make sure that we get onto Oprah or some of the big talk shows. And in fact, in my own experience recently, I've noticed that the authors who are going to be critical of mainstream media, particularly advertising media, do not get a platform as readily as those who do not make such political statements. There's a fair amount of media self-censorship taking place right now. It's very subtle. It's not something you can prove. But those authors who tend to be more outspoken about things such as inordinate influence of advertising and the drug industry, they don't see themselves on the talk shows as frequently or as readily as other spokespersons who tend to be less political.
You know, another of the criticisms that's been labeled at the healthcare system, certainly in the past, is that it skews male. That not only are a lot of doctors male, but people who are doing medical research was male. And in if you set aside things that are specifically obstetric and gynecological in nature, a lot of the research was based on research that had been done on men. And you take a problem like a heart disease, for example, it was very much geared toward men because it was thought of as being a men's disease. The research was done on men. Men were more aggressively treated. When women came in, if they presented with some of those symptoms, often doctors would dismiss it by saying, well, you're a woman. Guys have heart attacks. Women don't have heart attacks. And this is something that, and I wonder to what extent things like that have started to change.
Well, there is some truth in that. And there are areas where we extrapolated from research on men to women in ways that were not appropriate. However, sometimes this has been over-exaggerated. Mm-hmm. The truth is we are doing a lot more research on women's issues right now, and our Office of Research on Women's Health, quite ably directed by Dr. Vivian Penn, has been helping to coordinate research at our National Institutes of Health so that the different institutes try to keep in touch with each other, try to make sure that there are synergistic effects and where people are in good touch, and making sure that if there's research being done on kidney disorders or autoimmune disorders, that the appropriate institute is in touch with other institutes that might have an interest in this area. We certainly have seen some areas ignored. Some of these autoimmune disorders like Sjogren's syndrome and scleroderma and fibromyalgia, lupus, they disproportionately affect women. In the case of lupus, 90% of the people who deal with this condition are female. So it's been good to see an increase in interest in those areas. The chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome, known as myalgic encephalomyelitis in Europe and in some medical circles here, had been for a long period ignored or suggested to be primarily a psychological problem. And I think it's much more complicated than that. There are many dimensions to this condition we don't understand. And we are seeing research coordinated at the federal level that will move us further along. We're very happy to see this, and I think because of the women's health movement, and obviously because of the interest of industry, pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, we've certainly had a lot of lobbying for more dollars to fund research. Breast cancer research dollars have increased substantially because of the advocacy work of breast cancer activist groups, and some of them have been very sophisticated, saying we just don't need more dollars thrown at new chemotherapy and radiation regimens. We need dollars thrown at true prevention research. We need to understand better what are the causes of breast cancer. We do not understand that well at all right now, and we need to see if we can tease some of these issues out. Are there environmental factors we need to better understand? Some of the women's advocacy groups wanted us to study organochlorines more closely. That is happening. Very creative funding allocation was made several years ago when the Department of Defense set aside over $200 million for breast cancer research. And this was largely because of advocacy work and some senators who were very creative in figuring out how to get more dollars allocated for this issue. One of the national groups, the National Breast Cancer Coalition, is involved with organizing grassroots organizations to lobby their local folks who set policy both at the hospital level, the research level, the government level, to make sure that the issues that we care about get addressed, that clinical trials are conducted properly and adequately, that we don't, for example, see a lot of women rushing into bone marrow transplants, what they call the ABMT, plus high-dosage chemotherapy, so that women who were in late-stage breast cancer were engaging in a treatment whose benefits had not been adequately demonstrated. And they were choosing such treatments instead of being randomized to an important federally funded clinical trial so that we could understand whether or not this made sense. And I think this autologous stem cell rescue approach, this bone marrow transplantation plus high-dosage chemotherapy, has been shown not to be particularly effective at this point, but many, many women underwent this expensive procedure thinking that it really did hold out benefit for them when we didn't have that evidence. And many of us are trying to make sure that we don't let claims be made for procedures, for drugs, for therapies that may look promising at the outset but haven't been adequately assessed. And we need to do that before we start making claims and encouraging women to engage in these practices or take these drugs in advance of their demonstrated benefits.
Hmm. We're getting close to the midpoint of the program here. I do again want to introduce our guest. And we're speaking this morning with Judy Norsegian. She is a senior program officer at the Boston Women's Health Book Collective and also is co-author of Our Bodies, Ourselves for the New Century, which was published in 1998, a major revision and update of this classic book on women's health, Our Bodies, Ourselves, which was the first published in 1970. And I do again want to mention the fact that she will be here in Champaign-Urbana this weekend. She'll be speaking at the annual awards dinner of the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers on Saturday. There are still tickets available, we're told. And if you would like to attend the dinner, all you need to do is call the Healthcare Consumers 352-6533. And if you have questions and you'd like to be in on the conversation here this morning, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You know, here on this show, on this radio show, for something like 17 years or maybe a little bit more, we've been doing a show on women's health every month.
Wonderful.
And with the same guest all these years, a woman, OBGYN, who is in practice here in our area and who teaches in the med school. And one thing that is very, very striking when you look at the kinds of things we've talked about over the years and the kind of questions women have answered, there has been a tectonic shift toward the concerns of women who are approaching at or past menopause.
Right.
And we've certainly talked a lot about hormonal replacement. And I know this is an area of some controversy. It's a very big subject, but I wonder how it is you think about the issue and how it is we've talked about the issue of the needs of women at menopause and after menopause.
Well, The most important message about hormone therapy is that it's not for every woman. And the decision whether or not to use hormone therapy is not a simple one. The best reference we have seen is something put out by the National Women's Health Network called Taking Hormones and Women's Health. It's available from them in Washington, D.C., and they also have an excellent website called womenshealthnetwork.org. This is a publication that's been updated every couple of years, brings the latest information from the National Institutes of Health, also has some material about alternative approaches to dealing with menopausal discomforts, addresses osteoporosis, the question of heart disease, the benefits of hormones vis-a-vis heart conditions. And as you know, the data have been changing over the last few years, and it's not a simple picture. There are certainly benefits, but there are certainly risks. There are also questions that women need to ask themselves about whether they are, in their individual circumstances, at higher risk for osteoporosis. Some women can know that, others can't. Certainly, with respect to heart disease, there is a hereditary component, there's a huge lifestyle component, and many of us can know from our history, from our own lifestyle, whether factors in our lives put us at increased risk. If we lead sedentary lives, if we drink a lot of alcohol, if we smoke, if we are thin-boned, you know, there are things like that that will certainly put us at higher risk for developing brittle bones and at an earlier stage. If our calcium intake has been low, if we've had certain conditions that have been problematic, if we've taken progestins over the long period, some women who've taken Depo-Provera, for example, an injectable contraceptive, have seen that their bone mass has diminished immeasurably. These kinds of things weigh in on whether or not we're likely to be at higher risk. There are benefits, there are risks. You have to get all the information and make an important and considered decision yourself. One of the things that's so interesting about hormone therapy is that many women have simply voted with their feet in terms of how they felt. A phenomenon that is not well understood is that some women get an estrogen or an estrogen progestin prescription, go buy the product, and they find that they either feel so much better they continue using it because they like how they feel taking hormones, or they start feeling rotten, and they just decide, I don't care about osteoporosis, I don't care about the future, because if I feel this rotten, there's no point. So many, many women have simply decided to use or not use estrogens based on how they've made them feel, or combined hormone therapy. And there is a difference. For some women, definitely they feel worse when the progestin is added. Of course, it's added because it reduces the likelihood of endometrial cancer developing. But some women seem not to react well to the progestin component. Not well understood, but certainly a phenomenon that many, many women have reported. So even after one decides that she may want to try hormone therapy and thinks it might benefit her, she may be in that group of women who does not feel good on hormone therapy and doesn't like the way she wakes up in the morning or feels during the day. Sometimes there are mood alterations, and that might weigh in as a bigger factor than anything else about a future risk. So it's a very personal matter. It has to be an individual matter, and we encourage women to become well-informed. There are actually several good websites, the National Women's Health Network and our website, ourbodiesourselves.org, lead viewers to very good resources on this hormone therapy question and the whole issue of how to deal with menopause and reduce the likelihood of bones becoming brittle, losing their bone losing one's bone mass, obviously having enough exercise, adequate calcium intake, making sure you get those dark green leafy vegetables in your diet early on, not just at midlife, but early on when we're laying down our bone mass. These things are very important. They're also important for just how we feel. Diet and exercise are so crucial to an overall sense of well-being, not just heart health and some things about the future, but very much how we feel in the present.
Mm-hmm. I think the doctor that we've had all these years has said very much the same sort of things that you have, and in responding to questions from callers about what they should do, it seems that she has said so many, many times, I've heard her say, well, one of the first things you have to do is sit down and decide what it is you're trying to achieve.
Right.
And as a way of answering that question or in the process of answering the question, you do have to ask a lot of questions about, well, what you have to have a good medical history. You have to know about kind of where, what your risk of certain things are. You got to know about, well, if you're concerned about bone loss, what's your, where's your, are your bones now? And all of that, it seems that, though, bearing in mind that maybe one of people's big complaints is that they don't get enough time with their doctor, whether particularly women who are in managed care situations are going to actually be able to spend enough time with their doctor to have this kind of detailed conversation about who they are and where they are and what they're, where they're trying to get
to.
And
it's not just doctors. I mean, and now more and more women are seeking information, and I think in some cases getting better information from nurse practitioners, from midwives, from nurses that they meet in various settings. But all of these practitioners are struggling with the fact that women are increasingly influenced by media images in movies, television, not just the advertising, but the images that really drum into women's heads the idea that we've got to be thin, unhealthfully thin, so they're going on dangerous diets, they're engaging in dangerous cosmetic surgery practices, and many, and also taking diet amphetamines and other diet drugs that are really quite unsafe. And they're having to struggle with this obsession with thinness, even though many physicians know this is not a good thing. How do you respond to that when women come in and ask for certain products or want to look a certain way that may not even be healthful? They also have to deal with the fact many younger women think fat in the diet is bad. Well, fats are critical. There are good fats that we have to have in our diet, and not, you know, the deep-fried fatty foods with all the saturated hydrogenated fats, but even some saturated fats are important, not necessarily the kind that we've been eating. Some naturally occurring saturated fats aren't bad for us. This is not a simple issue. But a young woman who is trying to take all the fat out of her diet is probably headed for some serious trouble. We need these fats. And, for example, omega-3 fatty acids are not produced by the body from other substances. They have to come from the food we eat. And these are critical fats in the development, reproductive development, and women generally don't understand this because their sources of information about diet are sometimes misleading. And there is a big hype about low fat and no fat that has generated a whole generation of younger women that in some cases don't have the right kind of fat in their diet that they really truly need.
It seems unfortunate, and maybe I guess we really shouldn't be surprised because of the power of the mass media that is at this point still in 2001 that women should be beating up on themselves so much because of their bodies and because somehow somebody has created a completely unrealistic ideal and said, this is what you're supposed to look like, and if you don't, there's something wrong with you.
Well, if you don't, you need to buy this product.
Well, yeah, exactly. And not, yes, it's, if you don't look like this, we've got something that we can fix you. And whether it's something in a pill or whether it's cosmetic surgery or, you know, whatever it is, there definitely is that. Maybe that's the issue, that it's that people have found that they can make a lot of money capitalizing on women's unhappiness about the way that
right.
they look.
And it's a pity we see so much attention to things like that and so relatively little attention to things like sexually transmitted infections. Chlamydia is a serious problem for younger women, human papillomaviral infections, gonorrhea continues to be a problem, and then of course there's HIV/AIDS. And we have taken a long time to generate sufficient interest in both the it's mainly in the for-profit sector, but in doing research on new products like microbicides that women could use themselves to protect themselves from contracting HIV and other sexually transmissible organisms. This is a huge epidemic in this country, and not enough general media attention is given to the importance of protecting ourselves from a whole host of organisms and viruses that damage our health and well-being and sometimes cost us our lives.
How do you think about, or how do we encourage people to think about the issue of the fact that the culture, it seems, is increasingly sexualized, and that young girls, sometimes very young girls, are just steeped in this, and that we got real concerns. There's real reason to be concerned about sexual activity in younger kids, and for a variety of reasons, sexually transmitted disease being one of them. How does one confront this aspect of the culture that seems to be of real concern and also something that is so big that it's difficult to get a hold of and in any way turn around?
This is a very tough one because there's so much violence and so much sex, unsafe sex, violent sex, inappropriate in terms of relationships being portrayed as oppressive and exploitive, and very few what I'd call positive role models for younger girls and boys. Offsetting this mass media barrage is a very difficult thing. It's not easy to do it in one session in a classroom, part of a sex ed program. It really has to be something we bring into our homes, into our community groups, into regular discussions with healthcare providers, as to the extent we can influence script writers and people who are engaged in mass media messaging, that's great. I myself have a recommendation for anyone who cares about this issue, because I do think it's a really serious problem, and that is get some of the very inexpensive videos that exist, show them in your home, in your schools, and generate some discussion among younger women and men, and keep the discussion going. The National Now Foundation has produced an excellent 18-minute video that only costs $10, and it's called Redefining Liberation, and it looks at the health effects on women of tobacco, alcohol, and fashion industry advertising. And it does it in such a compelling way that I've seen wonderful conversations develop and continue among high school and college-age women. It's not necessarily for younger girls, but that is something that any one of us can do. We can get it to our phys ed teacher in the local high school. It's very appropriate. It really generates good discussion in it, and I think a heightened awareness of the need for media literacy among young men and women who've grown up with a slew of media messages, the minority of which have been positive. And so that's a first step. Encourage media literacy. For those who are teachers, who are in social service settings, there's an excellent video put out by the Cambridge Documentary Films Group here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that is called Beyond Killing Us Softly, The Strength to Resist. And it has many interviews with middle school girls. It really explores how young girls lose their voice, how it happens in society. There are interviews with Carol Gilligan and Gail Dines and Jean, several very prominent spokespersons and analysts who've looked at mass media and its particular impact on girls and young boys as well, because we all are subjected to these messages. And looking at these videos that I think are very insightful, very hard-hitting, and thinking about what it means in our own lives, what we might do, it's a first step. But there's no quick fix. Obviously, we have a huge media industry that's sending out a slew of messages that are antithetical to what many of us believe in. You know, I think we have to remember that Britney Spears is the first real sex pot who was, or I should say sex idol, who was marketed explicitly to seven-year-olds in this country. Hmm. Before that, we never saw such marketing aimed at seven-year-olds. That was the exact plan, and they succeeded. So if you are appalled by some of the behaviors and aspirations and ideals and thoughts and feelings expressed by younger girls, some of it very explicitly misogynist, you can understand it better if you see what kinds of marketing and advertising and media images young girls have been exposed to, especially if they consume a lot of mass media.
Yeah. It was not all that long ago, certainly within our lifetime, that the predominant message that women got about their sexuality was you're supposed to be a virgin when you get married, and then when you get married, you're going to have sex with this guy, and this is the only guy you're going to have sex with for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Very different, of course, than the message that men got. And one of the things that happened as a result of the women's movement, and it's not just the women's movement, but we sort of swept away that idea, and we said to women that they have a right to be sexual beings. There's nothing wrong with having sexual desire and looking for sexual satisfaction. And sometimes
there's
I think
only nothing wrong with it. It's in fact a wonderful
that
thing.
It's whatever indeed. And yet at the same time, I think then now in some respects the women's movement has taken a hit on this because some people have said, see, now here's the proverbial Pandora's box. We've opened it up, and now sexuality is sort of out of control, and now we've got this problem with seven-year-old girls who want to be Britney Spears. And how does one strike some kind of a balance here between You know, what's healthy and what is excessive.
Right. Well, first of all, it's patently untrue that the women's movement has had anything to do with what I've been talking about. In fact, the women's movement has been struggling against this kind of offensive, misogynist media imagery. The women's movement was very rightfully looking at the question of reproductive and sexual health more broadly, looking at the importance of mutually respectful sexual relationships, relationships where women in and outside of marriage can express themselves, be satisfied, engage in loving relationships, or relationships at least were satisfying in some way, not harmful, exploitive, oppressive, in ways that many relationships have been and continue to be for women. This is very different from anything you would see in terms of what I call these more exploitive messages that are out there. And to blame the women's movement for that is ridiculous. And there's no evidence to support a link between anything the women's movement has done and what we're seeing right now. What we're seeing right now is that things like pornography and much of this negative imagery and this kind of advertising, it sells products, it sells videos and magazines, and it makes somebody money. And anything that makes money in this country, you know, is a go. I must say that I think we win the prize in the world for putting the amassing of financial resources above and beyond practically everything else in terms of a culture. Even Europeans look at this culture askance and say, you know, why is it that money is so glorified in this country above and beyond so much else? Sexual pleasure can and still ought to be a goal of many of us. And in the women's health movement, we have supported the pursuit of sexual pleasure. It needs to be obviously done in a way that preserves our health and well-being. With the reality of AIDS and HIV and other sexually transmitted organisms, one has to be really mindful about sexual relationships. It's not a simple thing. And it's important to be informed and educated and to be careful. But that doesn't mean you are going to be miserable or don't have to be involved at all with partners in terms of having sexual relationships. Abstinence-only sex education does not work for the most part, and is, in fact, I think, doing us a great disservice. And I'm quite disturbed to see greater and greater amount of federal money going towards abstinence-only programs that don't give young people the kind of information and support they truly need to be responsible and loving in their sexual relationships with others.
We have a caller, somebody from a car phone, so I want to not make them wait any longer. We'll go right there, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to make a general comment. I listen to the show all the time. It's the most intelligent thing I hear on any of the mass media, both the 10 o'clock and the 11 o'clock hour. And I listen to a lot of professionals and academicians talking about the future of society and how we can correct things. And I just wanted to make the comment that it would be useful to listen to the song "The Times They're Changing" by Bob Dylan, in which he says, "Fathers and senators throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. The times there are changing," and obviously there are more words. The point is, I'm a professor and I teach a lot of students, and I'm in 50-plus years of age, and I agree that the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But in general, we can wish for times to be the way they were. As the New York Times reported yesterday, Ozzy and Harriet are dead, both literally and as a society. And basically, we can talk about what we want people to do, but it's not really going to have any effect on the young people. They're going the way they're going, and I'm glad that we issue warnings about where we're going, but I really don't see that there's a lot of hope in trying to modify behavior and trying to get people to adopt ideals that existed yesterday, let alone many years ago, and I just don't see that we can actually control the future. And I just wanted to make that kind of general comment. I enjoy listening to the conversations you have on with all your interviewees. But I don't see that we're actually ever going to accomplish anything. Thank you.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment. Ms. Norsegan, you want to comment on that?
We're not easily, and for me, it's not about changing new behaviors and new fads. I mean, that there's a lot that goes on that, you know, might not be my cup of tea, but it's not something that, you know, strikes me as good or bad. It's different. Like, people want to have their hair purple or red or piercing in different parts of the body. Well, sometimes there are risks. But, you know, there's fashion statements that people can make that are different from those before. And the thing is that what young people are exposed to, these very violent and, I think, really destructive media messages, by the way, they're not offset by a lot of positive role models sometimes. I think that this is not something that's put out there by young people. Many, many of the folks who foot the bill to put this stuff out there are in my age bracket. They're in their 50s, and they're making money on this stuff. And it's really not about what young people themselves want, and I think that's fine. And I do believe in a bit of this tipping point theory that you know, has been written and talked about, and sometimes a very small group of young people can create a fad that spreads, and the media picks up on it, and we're not going to control that, but there is a certain amount that's being controlled, not by young people, but by those who control what they're exposed to. If you analyze what's out there in the media now, you do not see the variety you saw 10, 20 years ago. You see the media controlled by about 5 to 7 large corporations, and the messages getting narrower and narrower. The range of options for living, behaving, being, they're not like what they used to be. And I think this is a serious problem. If you don't have diversity in behavior and ideas and viewpoints, and young people basically grow up with a narrow view of what possibilities are out there, what, you know, what do people do with their lives, it's going to affect us all. And I am not surprised that so many communities are seeing rising rates of violence against women, rising rates of other kinds of problems. And we certainly want to do something about that. And I see lots of younger people who are activists, just like we were activists 30 years ago. They're using the Internet. They're not getting on mass media with their messages, but they're using the Internet. They're creating active campaigns to deal with threats to the environment. They're trying to do something about the debt of many third world countries. They're part of the Jubilee 2000 effort. They very effectively organized to challenge the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and descended upon Seattle with a very effectively organized protest. That really surprised many people, but the use of the Internet, the sophisticated communications ability that younger people have now, even though they don't have access to the mainstream media, has certainly generated an awareness and a consciousness that is seeing that, you know, it's seeing us all now with a resurgence of student-based activism. Now, some of it might not always be to the point, and some of it might not always be getting at the maybe the true sources of our ills, but there certainly is an intention to do something about it, and I think that's good.
We have a couple minutes left. We have two callers. We'll try to get at least one, if not both. First in line is Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Yes, hi. I have a quick question. I hope you haven't covered this already. Can you give a recommendation of a book to give teenagers, a sort of sex education book? I have a niece and nephew, and I've been looking for something good. I haven't found anything I liked.
Yes.
Juvenile.
There is a wonderful book that was produced by members of our group, the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. It's in the spirit of Our Bodies, Ourselves, but it's geared to 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, depending on their level of sophistication. It's called Changing Bodies, Changing Lives. But if you're looking at something for
us, boys, too?
Pardon me?
For boys, too?
Yes, it's for boys and girls.
Oh, good. Okay.
And it deals with everything that a young person might be coping with.
Mm-hmm.
There's also something put out called Teen Voices. It's a fabulous magazine put out in Boston, but has national distribution, and they have their own website. And it is glossy. It looks like 17, but it's got very different kinds of messages, and it covers all the issues that young people would be interested in. Now, this is geared to young women mainly.
Okay.
There are also two other magazines, New Moon and Blue Jean magazine, that deal with younger age groups.
Yeah, and my niece is already 17. Maybe she's too old for these things.
A 17-year-old might like Changing Bodies, Changing Lives.
Okay.
It deals with a lot of these issues.
For right.
younger people, something called It's Perfectly Normal. It's a more cartoon approach by Roby Harris. more like 9 to 11-year-olds.
Yeah, that's what I've seen in the bookstores is that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I want something that's good and thorough on birth control because these are people whose parents do not tell them about the stuff.
Well, our bodies ourselves is the best thing on birth control. So
okay.
If it's a 17-year-old who needs birth control, I'd go to that. That's a very long and thorough chapter, and we lead you to websites with more information.
Okay, I'll probably go for that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Emergency contraception information in terms of our leading you to a website.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. And I think we're going to have to stop there. My apologies. We have one caller we cannot take. But before we go, I do want to mention again one more time that our guest with Sparta Focus, Judy Norsegian, Senior Program Officer at the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, will be the speaker this weekend at the annual awards dinner of the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, Saturday, May 19th. There are still tickets available. You can call them at 352-6533 and find out more about that. In addition, Judy Norsegian is one of the authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves for the New Century, a major update of this classic that was first published in 1970. Now, this version came out in May of 1998. It is available now. It's in paper by Touchstone Books. Certainly should be out there in the bookstore. Ms. Norsegian, we want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Happy to join you.